This is Whitley Strieber, and you have made a courageous choice. You're listening to Dreamland, a truly free, non-commercial voice on the internet. And from 22,500 miles in the sky on 1.FM and the Global Star Communications Radio Network, we say it like it is. We take you where others will not take you. Dreamland, welcome to the edge of the world. Well, we've got a great show for you this week. William Henry's going to be talking to Andrew Collins, and it is mind-bending. Also, Andrew will be talking to me in the subscriber section, and I'm asking him a question. Crop circles, floods, UFO reports, all kinds of incredible things happening in England. So why England? This man with his deep knowledge of the Neolithic past and what was really going on in England has got some fascinating answers for us. Also, the third week of our crop circle meditations, we're going to be talking this week about the law of three and the butterfly effect, just how much power you actually have if you focus it, as learned by us in this extraordinary meditation experience. And now here's William.
Science writer Andrew Collins is one of the best researchers on ancient cosmological, astrophysical, and astronomical mysteries living today. When I read his Gods of Eden in 1998, I was just simply blown away. It's one of the best books on the Nephilim I've ever read. From Ashes of Angels followed and was also a superb work by Andrew. In search of answers to ancient mysteries, Andrew turned to Atlantis. His gateway to Atlantis and his dramatic conclusions about the true location of Atlantis shocked many. If you Google Atlantis, one notes that there are over 28 million pages that mention it. The top hit is for a resort, Atlantis, Paradise Island, Bahamas. Andrew followed the trail of clues left by Plato about Atlantis to Cuba and the Carolina Bays, where he studied strange craters. He proposed that a comet destroyed Atlantis in 10,500 BC. This doomsday event is still resonating in earthly affairs. In fact, in May 2007, astronomers announced new scientific evidence that a comet had struck in North America around 10,900 BC, which is identical to Andrew's proposals in his book, Gateway to Atlantis, published in 2000, and which has huge implications for the Atlantis myth. When the comet hit, unimaginable tsunamis engulfed Atlantis and a wall of fire swept North America. That's the latest thinking. Here to tell us about the impact of this comet, what it means to the story of Plato's Atlantis, and more importantly, what it means to us, is Andrew Collins. Andrew, great to have you back on Dreamland.
It's good to be back as well.
This is really incredible stuff here, and I want to congratulate you on this validation for your bold hypothesis. Tell us how you began to formulate this idea in the Gateway to Atlantis, your proposition that Plato's concept of Atlantis was based on stories reaching the Mediterranean coming from the Bahamas and the Caribbean.
Okay, well, I think we have to sort of really go back to Plato's time. I mean, he lived around, let's say, 350 BC. And obviously this was a time of great speculation. His dialogues were almost the X-Files of their day. They were speculating on unseen things about the Earth and its relationship to the sun, the moon, the stars. And amongst the speculations in his books, were that there existed in what he referred to as the Atlantic Sea, which is our modern Atlantic Ocean, a island empire. Consisting of a series of islands focused around one main island. And he said that they existed up until the time of their destruction around 9,500 BC, that they existed in front of what was known as the opposite continent. Now, this is the words he used, the opposite continent, and the islands could be used as a series of stepping stones from the main Atlantis island all the way to the opposite continent. And he said that even in his, not in his day, but in the past, voyagers from his own world were able to reach the opposite continent by going via Atlantis. In other words, this was a staging post at some point within the Atlantic Ocean. Now, he gives various clues as to the location of Atlantis. He says that after the parts of it that sank were no longer there, that the voyagers could no longer navigate this area because the waters were too shallow and were filled with, like, a mud, he says. And what's interesting is that other contemporary writers of his age talk about this same area of the Atlantic, but add something very vital that, that Plato did not put. And they say that this area was covered in seaweed. And we now know that this is quite obviously the Sargasso Sea, which stretches, it's an area of floating seaweed that stretches from the Azores in the mid-Atlantic right the way across to the edge of the Bahamas. And beyond which, of course, are the very shallow waters of the Bahamas themselves. And very gradually, I built up a picture that seemed to show that Atlantis was placed somewhere off the American continent, which is obviously at Plato's opposite continent, because that's where anybody would have reached if you were going across the Atlantic eventually, not anywhere else. And therefore, we were looking for a very large island surrounded by other islands, somewhere off the North American coast. And it became obvious by looking into other writers from his era that there was knowledge known at this time of these islands that were called Hesperides. Basically, it meant the islands of the setting sun, and that they were placed in the very area that we now know as the Caribbean and the Bahamas. And I concluded that the main island was Cuba because there were a number of similarities between the main island of Cuba and the central island of Atlantis, with the actual sunken areas of Atlantis in the area of the Bahamas and the Caribbean, which had sunk or been drowned at the very end of the last ice age. So this gave us an approximate area. But of course, then you have to start looking at the fact that Atlantis was destroyed, seemingly by earthquakes and floods, according to Plato. So what type of scenario would have caused this? And the current theory, which seems to be growing, as you mentioned at the beginning of the show, is that there may well have been a catastrophe, a cataclysm at the very end of the last ice age, one that seems to have devastated North America, creating incredible firestorms that swept across the entire country, bringing with them all sorts of other problems and cataclysms and floods and things like this, and that the main culprit of this was seen to have been a comet breaking up in the air, and that small pieces of this would devastate the ground beneath them, very much like the so-called Tunguska explosion of 1908, which is now generally thought to have been caused by a mini comet exploding in midair. If you can imagine this occurring hundreds of thousands of times across different parts of North America, and you begin to understand what type of devastation was going on. And it's now estimated that up to 70% of the North American human population was destroyed at this time, along with a large number of other Ice Age animals, like the giant sloth, camels, different types of horses, various other animals of this period, just no longer existed after this time. And there's good evidence that they also were destroyed in this massive cataclysm. And if this did occur, then we have to start looking at its implications for the Bahamas and the Caribbean. How would they have been affected by all this? This is where I come in with my theories.
And in your opinion, you believe there's compelling evidence that both the Bahamas and the Caribbean once supported a high culture with maritime capabilities, and that it was again, devastated by this island cataclysm. Talk about that culture for a moment. Describe the kind of people that lived in Atlantis, according to your research, and if they had foreknowledge of this impending cataclysm.
Well, ever since the 1960s, considerable amount of interest has been shown in the Bahamas, possibly supporting some kind of high culture or lost civilization through the writings and readings of Edgar Cayce, America's sleeping prophet. Mm-hmm. And their people, the ARE, or the Edgar Cayce Foundation, have repeatedly carried out a number of explorations into this region looking for underwater archaeology. And very little was actually discovered, you know, until quite recently, within the past 5 or so years, Dr. Gregory Little, a scientist, has been working with archaeologist Bill Donato in this area and has discovered off of Bimini and off of Andros a whole series of keys and works and whatever, breakwaters, which were clearly created at some ancient time in the past, several thousand years ago at least, and some of the latest stuff would suggest that it was there much earlier than that, possibly as early as 10,000 BC. Now, we've known for a long time that a monument existed off Bimini known as the Bimini Road, which stretches for a distance of something like about a quarter of a mile and is made up of huge cyclopean blocks. Now, there's been a lot of controversy as to whether this is a natural feature or a artificial feature, and I think that we can conclusively say now that it is artificial. But this alone was not enough. But what's mounting year after year now is that there was evidence of a maritime culture in this region. Various anchors have also been found, stone anchors have been found in close proximity to these features. And something was going on there several thousand years ago, and we're hoping that the evidence will also show that this was something that was even older than that, that goes back to the time of Atlantis. And I think what's important here is to remember that across North America in, let's say, 10,000 BC, there were a thriving culture, the so-called Clovis culture, or Clovis people, and that they would have unquestionably have had the capability to go to the Bahamas and the Caribbean, or certainly some of their relatives or cousins would have done so, and that almost certainly life thrived in North America and obviously in the Gulf at this time. And yet something happened to completely knock it all on the head. You know, something occurred. And I think that had the cataclysm not taken place, then it's very likely that a lot of the foundations of civilization, which we know to have occurred in the ancient world, you know, as the Bible tells us, or archaeology itself in the Near East, that a lot of this would actually have taken place in North America, and the original Garden of Eden would have been in North America, or indeed, you know, the Caribbean or the Bahamas at that time. But our comet struck.
Andrew, I want to follow up on that. We have to take a quick break right now. That is an incredibly shocking and profound thing that you said. The Garden of Eden may have been in North America or the Bahamas. This is William Henry. This is Dreamland. We'll be right back.
We've now reached our third meditation in the Crop Circle series. This one is going to be called The Butterfly Effect. It relates the first two meditations in this series to the butterfly effect, and most importantly to you and the enormous power that a directed mind can have in this world. We can change things, and that is probably what this meditation series is all about, empowerment. Don't miss it in the subscriber section this week. And if you want to know more, read the transcript of the chat I did last weekend about the meditations. It's very informative. Don't miss this series. Subscribe to Unknown Country today if you are not a subscriber now. Do not miss this.
You're listening to Whitley Strieber's Dreamland Online.
Are we in the grip of a powerful and ancient secret society? Does the Illuminati run the world? Is every war, revolution, new disease, and new idea released upon the world by shady men who work in the background?
These are the questions addressed in Philip Gardner's new DVD, Secret Societies, an extraordinary new DVD, richly illustrated from Philip Gardner's own reality films. Don't miss it. Get it now from the UnknownCountry.com store. Click on the store tab on UnknownCountry.com right.
This is William Henry. This is Dreamland. We're continuing with Andrew Collins. Andrew's website is AndrewCollins.com. Andrew, here in Nashville, we have this incredible place called the Bicentennial Capitol Mall. One of the features of this place is it has a billion-year timeline telling the history of the state of Tennessee beginning in 1996 and going back 1 billion years. At the 10,000 BC marker, it describes some kind of a, it doesn't say cataclysm, it talks about how there was the Ice Age and an interruption in civilization and how humankind had to resettle and redevelop complex settled societies after this time. What you were saying before the break is just incredibly powerful about this idea that North America may have been the place where the Garden of Eden was originally located, possibly the Caribbean or even Cuba, as you're suggesting. Can you talk about that in more detail? What led you to that conclusion?
What led me to that conclusion was simply the fact that life thrived in the Americas around 10,000 BC. Yes, there was an ice age, but the ice age only reached down to a certain level. The ice sheets, the ice flow basically ended, just below the Great Lakes region, probably slightly lower than that may be. But beyond that, you know, life went on as normal, as it were. And there was an incredible high culture going on, you know, amongst the Clovis peoples, as is shown by, you know, the Clovis points and the incredible advanced settlements that they constructed. And this was so similar to what was going on in the ancient world at a similar time. And yet, obviously, the ancient world didn't undergo the same type of cataclysm. Yes, it would have been affected by whatever was going on in North America. I mean, there would have been a virtual nuclear winter at this time, which in itself would have created a resurgence of the ice, because around this time, the ice had actually been receding for up to several thousand years. The ice age was on the way out, and then suddenly it comes back, only for about 2,000 years, something known as the Younger Dryas. Nobody really knows why that is. It's been suggested that it's to do with meltwaters from the ice flowing into the North Atlantic and changing the whole state of the Gulf Stream. But now the much better theory is that this was caused by what we would now know as a nuclear winter as a result of the cataclysm, as a result of the comet impact. In other words, it brought with it this period where the sun would almost have been impossible to see, if at all. And this would have brought back the ice. It would have changed a lot of the waters of the world into ice again, and, you know, allowed the ice sheet to flow further south again. But only this only lasted a couple of thousand years. But the problem is that during this time, and through the cataclysm itself, it would have wiped out a large amount of people. As I said, latest estimates from the scientific team working on this is up to 70% of the human population of North America were destroyed at this time. They simply no longer existed after a certain date. So what happened to them? The chances are they were actually destroyed in these firestorms or any other resultant effects, anything from earthquakes to floods, to starvation through animals dying, you know, to famine through the loss of whatever crops or whatever, natural resources they had at their disposal. Now, what I'm trying to say is that if that cataclysm had not occurred, it's very likely that it would have been peoples from the Americas, from the Caribbean and Bahamas, discovering the ancient world at some point, not the other way round, as it was with Columbus. In other words, it may well have been that the first civilization in the world would have emerged in the Americas and not in the ancient world. And I mean, and if you want to use Plato's term for this, it was Atlantis.
Incredible. And so what we have here is a complete reversal, actually, of ancient history, because, in fact, what you're saying is that Plato didn't get his story from Egypt, as long been supposed. Instead, it's quite possible that the prime sources came from the Bahamas or the Caribbean.
I'm sure of it. I'm absolutely sure of it. And, you see, people will say, well, okay, you know, how did someone like Plato get to hear of this type of information? You know, how did he get it so right? And the simple fact is that there is a huge amount of evidence to suggest transatlantic contact from very earliest times. This, during his period, would probably have come from traders who were coming out of the Mediterranean via Spain or North Africa, most likely Phoenicians and Carthaginians. Now, these people were very, very secretive in their trade routes. They would rather scuttle a boat than reveal to any vessel that was following them where they were going. They were so secretive that it's almost certain that they were visiting North America and the Bahamas and the Caribbean, to trade, to bring back stuff to whatever they were doing there. And this knowledge was probably seeping into the Mediterranean world through stories and rumors that were going around the port, suggesting that there was some kind of island mass, you know, where people existed in the Atlantic. Now, they would have called them various names. The best name probably is the Hesperides. Plato refers to the same places as Atlantis, and other names might be the Blessed Isles, things like this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's important here is that if you look very carefully at the writings of some of the contemporaries of Plato, they talk about the journey times out to these islands, and we're talking something like 40 days. Now, if you went into a boat and travelled 40 days west into the Atlantic Ocean, it would bring you exactly to the Caribbean. It took, for instance, Columbus, I think, on his third journey, just under 40 days to reach the Bahamas. No, sorry, the Lesser Antilles in the Caribbean. So it's quite clear that if they were using the same trade winds, the same ocean currents, that these islands were being visited at the time of Plato. So we have here every likelihood that legends, myths, folklore that were current in these islands were being brought back into the Mediterranean world, just in the same way that the same legends relating to a cataclysm in the Bahamas and the Caribbean were told to those who followed in the wake of Columbus at the end of the 15th century. There are stories from the very north of the Bahamas, right the way down south into the Lesser Antilles, of a cataclysm that took place that split apart the island land masses into all of the different, you know, sort of archipelagos, the groups of islands that you have today. And these are often accompanied by the fact that something came out of the sky. A fire from the sky came out and hit the water. In one story that I read, it talks about the old moon breaking and falling into the sea and causing floods to completely break apart the island. Now, all of these stories were recorded by those that followed in the wake of Columbus that reached the Bahamas and the Caribbean. And they were obviously brought back into the Mediterranean world and written up in books, you know, generally by the Spanish. So the very same thing could easily have been going on during the age of Plato. And Plato was looking for these type of stories. And I think that he incorporated them into his works. And one of the key clues is the fact that a lot of the real names, the place names that are found in the Atlantis story, are of Semitic origin. Semitic language was spoken by the Phoenicians and the Carthaginians. There is no Egyptian names in the Plato myth, even though Plato himself claimed that the story came via a distant relative of his known as Solon from some ancient priest of Sais in Egypt. I actually do not believe that story. I think that that story was made up to cover the true source of where these stories were coming from, and that was probably from Carthaginians. Carthaginians were the sworn enemies of the Greeks, of which Plato was. There were still wars going on in Plato's age with the Carthaginians, and yet they were some of the greatest mariners that the world has ever seen. So for him to admit that these stories came from Carthaginians and, you know, not from some other more, higher, wisdom bringers like the Egyptians, would have been a complete no-no. I think he covered it up.
And, of course, it's the ultimate secret, too. It's the location of where the Garden of Eden actually was once located and where so much of history points to, but also it would have had tremendous economic benefits to those who were privy to
absolutely.
The secret as well. The cataclysm the cataclysm that you propose caused the destruction of Atlantis is identical to that being cited by the 25 strong scientific team at the American Geophysical Union.
That's
we get back
correct.
From the break, let's talk about this evidence and what it actually means to us.
Okay.
This is William Henry. This is Dreamland. We'll be right back.
Want to get a great premium and become a subscriber to UnknownCountry.com? Well, it's very simple to do both things. You can get a copy of William Henry's great 2-DVD set, Stairway to Heaven, when you purchase a 1-year subscription to UnknownCountry.com. So click on that subscribe tab right now. That's a $39.95 subscription, but you get a $19.95 DVD thrown in with it, meaning you're only paying $10 for 3 full years of Dreamland and all of our other great archives, plus the satisfaction of supporting UnknownCountry.com. But hurry, there are only 7 copies available for this offer, so subscribe today.
You're listening to Whitley Strieber's Dreamland Online.
This is William Henry. This is Dreamland. We're continuing with Andrew Collins. Andrew, scientists now believe that the cause of this massive cataclysm that caused a wall of fire to sweep across North America was a disintegrating comet which fractured into tiny pieces as it entered our atmosphere. You had already come to that conclusion. Let's talk about this new evidence that's come upon on the scene that has suddenly validated your theory.
Okay, well, recently in Acapulco, in Mexico, 25 scientists got together and basically stood up on a stage and said, we now have massive evidence for a firestorm that caused the cataclysm in North America around, they say, 12,900 years ago. That's 10,900 BC.
Right.
Now, there is obviously a slight discrepancy in dates here, but I don't think we need to worry about this because this is what we call pedantic.
Mm-hmm.
It's based on recalibration of carbon-14 dating, which is something that's quite controversial and can change dates, up to 1,000 to 1,500 years. But we're all talking about exactly the same time, a point of change, which is known as the end of the Pliocene Age, and the beginning of the Holocene Age. It's a geological term that are used by geologists. So there's no real discrepancy as far as dates here. But essentially, what they have done is to gain striking evidence from a whole number of sites across the US where, in other words, they've dug down, they've gone down to the level which is, you know, the transitionary point between the Pliocene and the Holocene period. And what they found is massive evidence, a whole layer of burnt material, which can only have been caused by massive firestorms. Now, this is from as far north as Canada, as far south as the area of the Carolinas. And something was going on right the way across, something which to them suggests, and as it had previously done to me in Galway to Atlantis, is that something had come from the northwest towards the southeast, causing mass devastation along its way, almost as if it was like an airborne object that was fragmenting into thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of pieces. And as each one of those pieces came towards the Earth itself, it, I don't know, seemed to explode, almost create an airborne explosion that created a crater, but not like the most obvious craters, the big round ones that you would see on pictures of the moon or the great, Arizona crater there.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But ones that were elliptical, that are quite shallow, that have directionality, a northwest-southeast directionality, and what are known generally as Carolina Bay. Now, these were first discovered in the 1930s when aerial photography was first invented, and it was noted that looking from above down onto the Carolinas, that there were literally hundreds of thousands of these elliptical craters. Most of them were now ponds filled with water. Some of them had been used as boundaries of fields for agricultural purposes, but they were clearly there, absolutely covering the whole landscape. And mm-hmm. these had never really been noticed from the ground before. And almost immediately, it was suggested that they could be the result of some kind of aerial impact. Meteorites was the most obvious solution. You know, in other words, this was the result of ongoing showers of meteorites over a very long period of time. However, carbon-14 dating from various of the Carolina Bay suggested that they'd actually all been fault around the same time, the period that, as I said, we call the end of the Pleistocene period. So, you know, that's around, let's say, 9,000 to 10,000 BC, you know, mm-hmm. give or take 1,500 years. It's the same time frame that we're talking about this firestorm. So you've got those, you've got the evidence of the firestorm. But what's also interesting is that there was a found amongst the sediment layers, which has evidence of this firestorm, these tiny globules of what they call nanodiamonds. Now, these are like very tiny, what would look like little glass balls. And they're actually formed under extremely high pressure and high temperature when an impact actually takes place. They've been found at various impact spots around the world. And they're thought, obviously, to have been caused by something of extremely high temperature, like a comet itself. Evidence of these was actually found at Tunguska in Siberia mm-hmm. in relation to the event of 1908. So this and other what they call possible extraterrestrial debris has been found at a number of these sites, which therefore seems to give massive evidence that this is indeed exactly what occurred.
Yeah, you mentioned helium-3.
Yes. Now, this is something which is a very rare isotope that's associated with the Earth. And yet, at these sites, evidence where the firestorms take place, it's there in abundance. And the only reason why it could be there in abundance is that it has an extraterrestrial origin. In other words, it came in with whatever extraterrestrial debris was being brought with the comet itself. Because, I mean, comets are essentially, for the most part, sort of ionized air, really, that's aflame. that's at extremely high temperature. But at the cause of them, it's thought that there is some kind of icy mass, something which, you know, is there as a core. So in other words, you have hard debris at its center, and that this would obviously eventually crash to Earth, probably fragmenting and causing, you know, a mixture of extraterrestrial debris with terrestrial debris. Now, when this happens with something like meteorites, or maybe even a very small asteroid, you get what known as tektites, and these are found at various sort of regions around the world where impacts are thought to have taken place. Interestingly, tektites have been found in the Bahamas and the Caribbean, and this is something that I've been trying to follow up for years. The local Bahamans call them thunderstones or thunderbolts, but all indications are that these marble-shaped, these pure spheres, some of which are like white or clear, others that are black, are almost certainly evidence of a comet impact.
And Andrew,
exact one, we don't know.
Did you keep up with that research on Tutankhamun's jewel? They believe that the green stone on Tutankhamun's
pectoral. Yes, that's very interesting, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, you know, the evidence has been there for years, but there's an area in the Sahara or the Libyan desert south of Egypt where there have been found a number of tektites which have this green appearance, very much like the Moldavite tektites that come from Eastern Europe. It does seem as if some of the jewellery that was found in Tutankhamun's tomb is actually made of these, actually fashioned from these tektites, which is very, very interesting because obviously you have to start looking then as to whether the people that collected these up and took them to the royal court were aware of their extraterrestrial origin and whether there may have been some connection here. But that's obviously something for another day, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredibly interesting question. I would love to talk with you about it more sometime.
Yeah,
Andrew,
we're
not sure where the epicenter of this proposed cataclysm was. Where do you suppose it was?
Well, okay, I think you've got to look at it this way. If you had, in your hand hundreds of thousands of pieces of something and you threw them through the air, the smaller pieces would fall, you know, at a distance not very far away. The larger pieces would continue on their velocity and gradually lose that power, that energy, and fall much further on from the smaller pieces. So I believe that we should be looking in the direction of the flow of the Carolina Bays, and that is almost certainly in the Western Atlantic Basin. In the area between, let's say, the Carolinas, Florida, and the Bahamas, I think this is probably the place. And indeed, back in the 1950s, a German rocket scientist wrote a book called The Secrets of Atlantis. His name was Otto Muck. And he was the first to note that in the Western Atlantic Basin were a series of large elliptical craters, is all you can really describe them as, that were also orientated northwest to southeast, which he then linked them with the Carolina Bays and suggested that these were the larger fragments of a comet that had struck the Western Atlantic Basin. Now he went on to suggest that Atlantis was in the area of the Azores, which, to be honest, there is very, very little evidence now to suggest that. So he sort of rather missed the point of how much impact these larger fragments would have had upon the Bahamas and the Caribbean. Because if you can imagine it, these huge pieces of a comet falling in the water, they would have created tsunamis which would have been hundreds of feet, possibly even thousands of feet in height, that that would have completely drowned the Bahamas and the Caribbean, killing almost everybody who would have been there at the time, destroying whole species of animals. And then they would have obviously receded. And then, of course, when the Ice Age finally ended, because these events led to a chain reaction that would eventually have caused the end of the Ice Age, what would have then have happened is the waters would have risen up for a second time and recovered parts of the island twice, which is actually what the ancient stories talk about. They talk about the islands being flooded twice, which I find really, really interesting.
Once by the tsunamis
of the cataclysm, and then afterwards by the gradual rise of the oceans to do with the end of the Ice Age.
Andrew, I've got to catch a break, and when we get back, let's talk about the possibility of the Hudson Bay area as being one of the epicenters as well. This is William Henry. This is Dreamland. We'll be right back.
You know, William Henry is a very special guy because he's on a quest, and it's a most unusual quest. Now, you can join him in a most unusual way. Recently, he gave an extraordinary lecture, Stargate 2012, Surfing the Tides of the Milky Way. Remarkable lecture at Chet Snow's Signs of Destiny conference. It is loaded with all new 2012 related material. Nobody knows for sure what will happen in 2012, but you can find out some very new ideas from William's latest lecture. You can get it is very simple. Just click on the store tab on unknowncountry.com, then scroll down to the William Henry store. You'll find it and so many other great William Henry items right in that store. Want to get a great premium and become a subscriber to unknowncountry.com? Well, it's very simple to do both things. You can get a copy of William Henry's great 2-DVD set, Stairway to Heaven, when you purchase a 1-year subscription to unknowncountry.com. So click on that subscribe tab right now. That's a $39.95 subscription, but you get a $19.95 DVD thrown in with it, meaning you're only paying $10 for 3 full years of Dreamland and all of our other great archives, plus the satisfaction of supporting unknowncountry.com. But hurry, there are only 7 copies available for this offer, so subscribe today.
This is William Henry. This is Dreamland. We're continuing with Andrew Collins. Andrew, it's thought that this comet might well have blown up over Ontario or the Hudson Bay area. What are your thoughts on that possibility?
I think that they may be looking a little short of the correct area. I think that the evidence suggests that it actually entered North America probably around the area of Alaska, and that it carried on causing craters in the area around the Yukon region, possibly around the Great Lakes, but certainly it reached as far south as the Carolinas and possibly even as far south as Florida before the final fragments hit the water and I think were lost there. So I think that to look for an epicenter in the area of the Hudson Bay would probably be wrong because I think that it was probably still in flight as it passed over most of North America, gradually releasing parts of it that were falling, almost like bombs, and hitting the ground, creating firestorms, whilst the main part of it continued on. So I really do think that you should be looking in the western Atlantic basin for the epicenter. I think that any possible craters that may be found in the Hudson Bay area are either maybe a fragment that broke off or they may be relating to a different event altogether. I'm not sure. But,
well,
it's common sense says you should be looking for the larger pieces in the Western Atlantic Basin.
Well, and the amazing thing here to me, I mean, the real incredible part is that you have these scientists that are saying they don't want to sound catastrophic, but there is significant evidence of a massive biomass burning, that the continent did burn. And I'm wondering, how has your theory been received? Have you talked with any of these scientists on this panel, and are they looking at some of your evidence as well?
I'm not aware of them being interested in any of my work, and so far I've not been able to make contact with them. I think that what I should do is to send them a copy of the Gateway Act to Atlantis and just say, have a look at this. But
right.
I think what's important here is that, you know, we're talking about academics here who are pushing forward a very revolutionary new idea.
Exactly.
They will have criticism at every stage that they go through. And at this point, if they started to link themselves with the Atlantis myth, I believe that that would be the death knell for their research. They have to do this very, very carefully. And in my own time, you know, I will contact them and speak to them and just send them a copy of the book. But I get the feeling that they're already aware of it. I get the feeling that that a few of the people involved have almost certainly read the book and that this may have given them a few ideas. I don't think that it's far-reaching to think that at all.
And something else that intrigues me about this verification of this whole Atlantean cataclysm idea during this time frame is we have to ask, wonder where that comet came from. The galactic center, is this also a nice piece to Dr. Paula Violette's puzzle about galactic winds sending debris Earth's way and being responsible for cyclical cataclysms? So some people believe we're overdue for such a cyclical cataclysm. Can what happened in North America these many thousands of years ago happen today?
Well, all we know is that there are a large number of comets that are on very long time cycles, whether it be, you know, 70 years, whether it be, you know, 1,000 years or anything in between. And they will come from the very outer parts of the solar system, the area where there is large amounts of stellar debris, you know, what we call asteroids, meteorites, comets. And these are knocked generally in the direction of the solar system by, I don't know, whatever is going on out there. And, you know, they go into orbit. They come into the very heart of the solar system. They then swing round the sun and go back out. And quite obviously, sometimes the planets are in the wrong place. You know, just like a few years ago, fragments of a comet hit Jupiter. And, you know, that must have caused incredible devastation where they hit. And mm-hmm. there is film which you've seen, photographs, that show all these, like, bead-like parts of a comet hitting one after the other, bang, 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 you know, Jupiter, as it's obviously turning on its own, on its own course. And, I mean, you know, if this had been the Earth, this would have caused untold cataclysms on Earth.
An extinction-level event, for sure.
This is just a natural thing. Mm-hmm. This is going to happen. Unfortunately, this is going to happen. And I think that if it is a comet that is going to be threatening the Earth, I think we're going to have far more of a problem than if it's a pure block of rock that we would call an asteroid. Because, as I said, a lot more of it is, you know, sort of ionized gas, which means that it's much more difficult to deal with. Although, as I said, at the heart of comets, it is believed that there is what they call like a dirty ice center, which is probably, you know, a lump of ice containing other sort of extraterrestrial debris with itself. So there may be some way of deflecting it from actually hitting the Earth. But mm-hmm. I think that we have to accept that this type of cataclysm probably occurs on Earth, you know, every, what should we say, you know, 10, 20,000 years maybe. And that, you know, it will occur again. Not in our lifetimes, let's hope, but certainly at some point in the not too distant future.
And one of the questions I have to get back to then, Andrew, is what does this evidence do for Casey's Atlantis? Does this challenge his theories? Does it support it? What are your thoughts?
It supports it in many ways, because he talks quite specifically about a cataclysm around around 10,500 BC, which interestingly is about 1,000 years earlier than Plato himself. He says around 9,500 BC. And what he says is that at this time, the very final remnants of Atlantis split up. And he cites those as in the area of the Bahamas and the Caribbean. And what he said is that this made the survivors of this cataclysm move into different parts of the world. And what we know is that there was a huge amount of migration around the world at this time. And that shortly after then, the very first stone temple, or certainly accepted today, in the world was constructed in the Near East, actually in southeast Turkey, a place called Göbekli Tepe. And here you have the most incredible stone monuments and standing stones with beautiful carvings of animals and birds and other symbolic forms. Suddenly comes out of nowhere. I mean, there was absolutely no precedent for it. The Ice Age was still there in parts of Northern Europe, and yet suddenly this culture emerges in what would later become the Garden of Eden of the Bible, the very area of the Kingdom of Eden, or the Land of Eden. And, you know, something has gone on there. These people have turned up from somewhere. Now, in the past, I've speculated that they came maybe from the Nile Valley, what later became Egypt, because of huge floods that had taken place at this time, made them have to move into much higher areas. So they went from one river, the Nile, onto another river, the Euphrates. And essentially this is how civilization began in the old world, the ancient world. But there was lots of things going on like this all around the world. The anthropologist Stephen Oppenheimer has talked about huge migrational activity going on at this same time, coming from Southeast Asia through Central Asia into Western Asia. And he believes that this may have caused the foundations of the beginning of civilization. He's probably right as well. There was an awful lot of migrations going on around 10,500 BC. And this is the very time that Casey talks about people turning up in places like Egypt and mixing with the indigenous peoples there and giving rise to what would eventually be the Egyptian civilization. So, you know, yes, in many ways, the answer is that this actually supports Casey's writing, reading.
Well, it's certainly going to change human history if we learn that the ancient world did suffer this cataclysm in this way, and that we have direct evidence of it. And we hope that this will become the reigning Atlantis theory, because what you presented is just absolutely overwhelming and totally compelling, Andrew. And I want to thank you very much for taking the time to share your research with us.
It's always my pleasure.
This is William Henry. This is Dreamland. Thank you all for listening. Next up, Linda Moulton Howe.
Linda Moulton Howe, unique in this world, a science reporter who dares to approach our environment with an open mind. She's willing to look at the deepest of mysteries, and her website, earthfiles.com, is the very finest website of its kind in the world. Do not let your day pass without going to earthfiles.com. Linda Moulton Howe, the best there is.
Want to get a great premium and become a subscriber to unknowncountry.com? Well, it's very simple to do both things. You can get a copy of William Henry's great 2-DVD set, Stairway to Heaven, when you purchase a 1-year subscription to unknowncountry.com. So click on that subscribe tab right now. That's a $39.95 subscription, but you get a $19.95 DVD thrown in with it, meaning you're only paying $10 for 3 full years of Dreamland and all of our other great archives, plus the satisfaction of supporting unknowncountry.com. But hurry, there are only 7 copies available for this offer, so subscribe today. Well, this week, Linda Moulton Howe, in this very turbulent time, has got another cattle mutilation story just a few weeks old. Yes, that's right. It is still happening. It is weird, and there are some features of this case that you really have never heard before. Linda Moulton Howe's website, earthfiles.com. It's where to keep up with what's really going on in science. The facts that others will not give you, or rather dare not give you, earthfiles.com. Now, here she is from Albuquerque, Linda Moulton Howe.
Thank you, Whitley. The modern era of worldwide animal mutilations goes back to the 1960s, and some say at least another 100 years before then. Canada had as many reports as the United States. For example, in August 1967, exactly 40 years ago, on the Sarcee River near Twin Bridges in Alberta, a dead horse was found where a witness claimed that a, quote, domed saucer craft, unquote, had been seen earlier that day. And then 3 months later, in early November 1967, two horses in Canada were found dead near Livingston, Ontario. One had a long cut on its neck. The other had its throat and jugular vein cut off. And yet, there was no evidence of blood. That was November 6, 1967. The day before, near Livingston, a man had reported seeing a large UFO in the sky. Since then, literally thousands of animals, including wild game as well as domestic, have been found with a similar pattern of bloodless excisions. An ear is cut off close to the scalp. On the same side of the head, an eye is often removed along with a circular excision of hide around the eye. Half the jaw flesh is cut out, along with the entire tongue from deep within the throat. In almost all cases, genitals are excised in neat oval or circular hide deep patterns, and often the rectum and or vaginal tissue is cored out as well, all without signs of blood or struggle. And now comes more cattle mutilation reports from the province of Manitoba, between July 8th and August 9th. Sheila Biggison has lived and farmed in Komarno for the past 12 years. Komarno is a very small rural community, only a couple of miles from a slightly larger town called Gimli that has a population of about 6,000. Both towns are near Lake Winnipeg, north of Winnipeg, Manitoba. And this summer, both towns are now on the animal mutilation map. On July 8th, Sheila found five of her adult cows and two calves dead with odd bloodless excisions of hide and circular excisions of teats from the udders. Her veterinarian came out to get tissue samples to send to the Canadian labs testing for anthrax, which had also suddenly appeared in Komarno and Gimli, much to the shock of farmers and ranchers who have never seen the dreaded disease there before. The next day, on July 9th, Sheila found another dead cow, and 2 days later, on July 11th, yet another cow and one of her bulls, bringing the total to 10 dead animals with excisions and one missing. When she got the test back, none of her animals had tested positive for anthrax, and she was very confused and troubled because there was no blood on the animals. They had been tested for anthrax. Anthrax causes animals to bleed. The veterinarian thought it was anthrax, but the tests were negative, and Sheila still had a total of 10 dead animals unaccounted for and an 11th cow that never turned up.
Just so weird to me. But what gets me is that, you know, nobody's done, like, you know, like I said, like, I've got 10 animals dead, and I don't know what they died from. You know, and I've never seen this with no blood. I mean, we've been farming. We got quite a bit of cattle. Like, I've had, you know, more dead animals. Like, I've never seen them like this, you know.
2.5 weeks later, on July 29th, a couple of miles down the road from Sheila's place, Greg Wojtowicz was working on Sunday afternoon, July 29th, around 3:30 p.m. Greg is 42 years old and has farmed in Gimli the past 11 years. One of his prize purchases only 2 years ago was a 10-year-old pedigreed Black Angus bull from Scotland. That bull weighed 2,700 pounds and was the best bull Greg had ever owned. That hot, sunny July 29th day, Greg and his brother were baling hay. Greg had just started making his first round of the pasture when he was perplexed about what he was seeing sticking up from pasture grass about 200 feet away.
And I made the corner with the tractor and the baler, and I looked over to my right, and I seen a leg sticking up out of tall grass, right? And there was a raven flew up. So I stopped the tractor, went over the fence, and walked out approximately 60 yards from the fence. And there was my bull. His head was facing north, and his legs were facing east. And I just walked up, and I looked, and I figured out, crap, because we have had anthrax breakout in the area.
Mm-hmm.
I phoned a veterinarian to come out and to take samples of it. You're cheesed off.
Mm-hmm.
And I just figured, well, it's no use standing around. The bull's dead. The bull's dead. And got back in the tractor and continued to bail. When the veterinarian came out, I returned back to where the bull was, and I noticed like he was missing his skin on his abdomen, and his scrotum was cut out, and I noticed his ear was gone. And I said to the vet, I said, you know, this is kind of weird. What's with this? And he just looked, and he said, oh, it's wildlife. And he took a sample from the neck, tissue sample, and that was it. So I says, well, can I bury him? He says, no, we have to send the test in. He says, so he's not going anywhere, so just leave him there, which I sort of found odd. If it's suspicion of anthrax, you got to, there's certain things you have to do, eh? In the meantime, I had phoned a number of vets. This was on a Sunday. It was a matter of an hour and a half or so from the time of discovery to the time that the vet showed up. So now when the vet came, I went with the vet to get the samples, and I was looking. And I said, you know, this is kind of odd. I said, you know, his ear is gone. And I said, look, you know, the abdomen, and I said, his scrotum's gone and everything. I said, so what's up with this thing?
Right.
And he replied, oh, it's just wildlife. The animals are getting at him. I just sort of, you know, like I said, you're teased off. Your bull is dead. He took the samples, and I closed the gate and carried on.
Huh.
In the meantime, like I said, it was a Sunday. I had talked to another vet that I usually deal with, and he contacted me Monday morning. Well, this other veterinarian said I should get in contact with Dr. Megan Bergman. She was in charge of the anthrax outbreak
mm-hmm.
with the Canadian Food Services.
Mm-hmm.
So I contacted her, and she said, well, have you covered him with a tarp? And I said, no. She says, well, could you do that as soon as possible? Why do they want it covered with a tarp in case it is anthrax? You cook him under the tarp, the hot weather we were having, and it kills these spores.
Oh, I see.
So I went back there, and I took a tarp, and I covered him. But as I was pulling the tarp over, I started looking, and I looked at the front, got a really good look at him, and said, you know, there's something wrong here. So I phoned that doctor back, and I said, you know, I was tarping him to cover him up, and I said, those are not wildlife wounds or whatever you want to call it.
Right.
Because I butcher my own animals for beef, and I've been skinning steers since I was 8 years old. And the way the skin was taken away, you can tell it's been skinned. So I phoned him back, and basically he gave me a blast. So he goes, well, there's no one touched that animal, this and that. He says, those are animals, wildlife did that, and on and on and on. I said, okay, fine.
Boy.
I said, whatever. So I went to work. I work for Natural Resources. And my district supervisor, he's been a game warden for 30 years. And I was telling him about this. And he says, there was something he had heard about not too long ago in Riverton. He had also lost a bull that was mutilated.
Mm-hmm.
So Irwin says to me, he says, well, come on. He says, I'll bring my camera. Let's go take a look. So we went out there, and I uncovered him, and Irwin's looking, and he says, geez, he says, you know, he's been up north and all over the place. He's been a game warden for 30 years. He says, I've seen caribou, I've seen moose, I've seen everything eaten from wildlife. And he says, there's no bloody way in the world that that's wildlife. So he says, if I were you, I would get a hold of the RCMP, the Mounted Police, eh?
Right.
So I phoned the RCMP, and they didn't sound surprised or shocked. They didn't call me an idiot over the phone by no means. They were just interested in the location of the animal. They wanted to go take pictures to compare them with some other photos that they had.
That were also current now.
Yeah. So they went out there, when they pulled the tarp off him, he was, like they were typical cops, he was white and crawling, and they just put the tarp back over him. But they requested that I give them copies of my photographs.
Mm-hmm.
So I went and did that. My test came back negative.
It came back negative for anthrax.
Yeah, it was the first test for negative, but her reason was the state of decay that the bull was in.
Mm-hmm.
That they couldn't get an accurate test, they had to send it to a better lab. So she went and sent the samples to the other lab, but in the meantime, they came out. I had the whole dug already, and we treated it as a positive anthrax case. And basically, they never even took the tarp off of him. They just sprayed everything down with disinfectant, and I pushed him in the hole and buried him. So in the meantime, I had these pictures, and that's when I went to show them to Sheila, because I heard that she had lost a bunch of animals. And she was actually just finishing burying some. I showed her the pictures. She says, I thought I was crazy. She said, some of mine, I know there was one that the tongue was missing, one was missing an ear, and the teeth were cut off. And she says, but I didn't want to say nothing. She says, because everyone's going to think I'm loony, eh? And I said, well, no. I says, well, look at my pictures. I says, this isn't wildlife. There's no way in hell.
Right.
Like a week later, she came and got my pictures, and she emailed them to you to get your opinion.
It's a classic mutilation. And over my years of animal mutilation investigations, some of the more puzzling details are bloodless puncture holes or what appear to be gouges in the hide, rather neat, no blood. And Greg Witoich's bull had a deep gouge in the armpit of his left front leg.
Yeah, I seen that. I was poking in there with a stick. As you see in the other photo, that's me in the photo poking with a stick.
Right.
And I was just seeing how deep it was.
And how deep did the stick go?
Probably 3 inches.
Well, those kinds of details have been found on bodies in which when necropsies were done, the heart has been found completely missing from inside the pericardium without a drop of blood inside the pericardium and no cut in the pericardium, but the entire heart muscle is gone.
Hmm.
That is work with a technology we do not have.
Oh, exactly. Like everyone that's seen these pictures, they says, what do you think? I says, who knows, aliens?
Right. That's what government people tell me it is.
Yeah, and they look at me like kind of funny and start laughing, and I says, well, you know what, if you think we're the only ones that walk on the face of the planet or anything else, I says, you're very naive.
And what I'm trying to understand is our government apparently knows and links global animal mutilations like what has happened to your bull to, in their own documents, they call them extraterrestrial biological entities. And the question is, why? What is this huge harvest of material from all these animals around the world that's been going on for a century? Why?
Yeah, and, you know, when I was talking with the constable of the RCMP, he was saying, he says, I don't know what it is, he says, but these animal mutilations in this area, you know, within, let's say, 100 square miles.
Right.
He said there's reports about them always at this time of year.
So from the bull, what is removed that you know about is the right ear down almost to the base.
Yeah.
The tongue.
Yeah.
The belly tissue that would have surrounded his exit of his penis.
Yeah.
And the testicles.
Yeah.
Has been removed in a very large oval, and that a second hole was made into the back abdomen area where the penile tissue is falling out of the animal.
Yeah.
The rectum, according to that one wide shot, was intact.
Yeah, and untouched.
Greg, what do you think about why should anthrax suddenly show up in an area where there are animal mutilations at the same time?
Yeah, well, exactly. This is another weird, weird situation. Like I said, I'm a fourth-generation farmer, and we've had cattle all along. I've never, ever, ever in this area, it doesn't matter, within, I would say, 100 square miles, we've never had anthrax.
And why now?
Yeah, and why now?
And Lois said the same thing. She said that authorities are trying to say that it was the construction of some kind of a water pipe.
Oh, no, it was a hydroelectric line.
A hydroelectric line, and that it stirred up the soil?
Yeah, well, that's bullshit. Okay, because, first of all, they didn't disturb the soil. All they did was they went through there with a hydro axe and just mowed the bush down. They never touched the ground.
And if non-humans are the ones involved in these Manitoba deaths in the last 4 weeks, would they be there because anthrax is suddenly flourishing and they're monitoring something? These are the kinds of mysteries. Why the focus in exactly the spot where anthrax has broken out that you haven't seen before?
Exactly. I'm very open-minded about that. Like I said, if anyone thinks that we're the only living creatures in this universe, they're very naive and sadly mistaken.
And when you think about that, that non-humans are involved with a global harvesting of genetic material, fluids, and all of that from animals around the world, including horses, cattle, goats, sheep, wild game, what are you left with as a residue in your own thoughts about that?
Like everything else, you know, maybe they have an agenda that they're following too, just like anyone else. Like me being a cattle farmer, that's my agenda.
Right.
You know, if there is someone from other planets or whatever flying around, well, they need this. Heck, all you got to do is stop and ask. I'm sure we could work something out.
You know, Greg, I completely agree with your attitude, and it is what has always puzzled me about why it is that our elected officials take this hard-handed approach that the public and the media will panic if we learn what they know, which I think is undermining our ability to be voting publics with governments that we trust. Nobody trusts the governments now because every government is lying to us.
Oh, I know. And it doesn't matter whether you're United States, you're Canada, you're Paraguay, or who the hell ever. It's all the same crap.
And if they did level and there was some way to negotiate with non-humans, okay, you need X animals. Well, we have to pay our farmers. So
yeah,
you do this for us in a trade deal.
Well, but you know what? Like, this what gets me. We have slaughtering plants.
Right.
I mean, instead, you can put one of your own people there, and as they're going down the line, oh, we want to sample this, that, the other thing.
Right.
You know, here you go, take it. Don't throw my bull out the pasture.
It's true. You're making an excellent point.
Yeah.
And all this secrecy and cover-up interferes with what could possibly be a reasonable and logical approach to their needs, our needs, and it would be win-win instead of this scary, destructive secrecy.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, if they have the technology to come and visit us whenever they want, I mean, probably would assume that they could just wipe out humankind at the flick of a button.
And the fact that they don't means that's not what they want.
That's right.
And the same day that Greg found his prize bull dead on July 29th, one of his cows gave birth to a male calf sired by that mutilated bull. So now Greg is going to watch this new little guy grow up, hoping that he will match his father's physical greatness. And Greg told me that only 4 miles down the road from him, back in Camarno, Lois and Steve Mattis also lost a cow to the strange bloodless excisions. Lois confirmed that on the morning of August 9th, she found one of her best 9-year-old cows dead and mutilated, a cow that she had seen herself alive in the early evening just the night before. Lois described how she found her cow.
And she was dead, and her ear was missing, and all 4 tips were missing. So when we got looking at it closer, the ear was definitely cut. You could see the mark where, when you cut into the hide, the white part inside the hide,
right,
like very visible, okay, and the tip, the two that were on the top definitely looked cut. The bottom two, it's hard to say.
Right. I agree. The top two have that circular excision that I have seen on other animals, and the bottom two look like predator. It's very confusing.
Yes, I agree. What happened next was CFIA came out, and they sprayed it with this Vercon, it's called, to kill the spores.
Did they comment on the strange excisions of the ear and the cheeks?
They asked if somebody had come and taken the sample, because CFIA does cut an ear off, okay? And we said no, nobody had been there. And Steve said to him, my husband, said to him, doesn't it look like they were cut off? And he said, yeah, I kind of thought so, but he didn't say anything.
And that is a comment on authorities around the world who know they are looking at excisions that are not predator, not disease, and not satanic cults, or something that falls into a category that they are literally afraid to address because it's not politically acceptable. And this phenomena goes on around us worldwide all the time. Right now in Argentina and Chile, the official count to veterinarians, to authorities, and to law enforcement outside of SANASA is that at least 3,200 bodies of animals of all kinds have been reported with these same kinds of excisions in Argentina and Chile since 2002. And the reports right now that are coming through Spanish translations seem to be increasing right now. And I want our Dreamland audience to know that these very important photographs of Greg's bull and of Lois's cow are at myearthfiles.com news website. At the top of the headlines page, there is a hot link to this report about these Manitoba new mutilations from July to August 2007. And why I think it is so important to share these images is that the world needs to understand that when you have circles in bellies of animals that should otherwise bleed, and there is no blood, not on the tissue and not on the ground, something extraordinary has happened, and law enforcement knows it, whether they admit it or not.
Whether they admit it or not, Linda, exactly. And what is so amazing about this is that it has gone on this long, and there is absolute uniformity in the law enforcement community. They will not admit it. They will not talk about it. Therefore, somebody is telling them not to, or there is a kind of culture of denial going on, because no sane person can deny these cases. It's not just, they're real.
Absolutely. And when you get to this area of the aerial lights and the gosh, so many sheriffs have told me, when these orange, red-orange, fiery spheres show up, we know we're going to have animal mutilations. That used to be the mantra of law enforcement in the 70s to the 80s. Well, right now, Argentina and Chile, my land, every week there are multiple translations coming about very odd aerial light, beams of light, even creatures that are being reported in a variety of towns over at least six provinces or states in Argentina and along the Andes border with Chile. And what's so interesting is in the United States and Canada in those earlier years of the 60s, the mutilations were constantly reported and linked to beams of light, spheres of light, and all of this strange light activity. Now, we've got classic mutilations up in Manitoba, Canada. And Greg Butoich is open-minded, but he said that he and his brother, they are out late at night, sometimes nearly all night. He said, you know, we're looking because we figure that this is something from outer space. But he said, we honestly haven't seen anything and nothing has been reported. That goes to another question, Whitley, you and I have talked about in the past. Could part of what is happening now in a new phase of the global animal mutilation be that in the northern hemisphere, that invisibility or some sort of blocking mechanism is now being used to block out the vehicles that are involved in the mutilation.
Well, you know, we saw instances of the drones literally disappearing before people's eyes, as I believe. Am I not correct about that?
Absolutely. Back and forth, in and out, in and out.
Yeah. Now, when you look at those extraordinary craft, or I almost want to call them contraptions, you see that thing, that spike hanging down from one of them. And I just wondered when I saw that. It had a sense of menace about it, and I wondered if it had anything to do with cattle mutilations, frankly.
But, you know, if you go to eyewitnesses going back 40 years, the most common denominator are the beams of light.
The beams of light, exactly. But but when you see a beam of light, if it's being emanated, if it's emanating from something dark, you can't see the thing at all.
And that is true, except for those eyewitnesses who have said that the beams of light were coming out of glowing oval discs.
And what about the Baptist preacher? What he saw, Linda.
I know, that unbelievable, what he said was a combination of something like a crab and a stingray, or something that was both reptilian and marine life, with those lobster-like legs, and then that sting thing coming into the cow. And
I hear stories like this and things like that, I hear someone saying, well, why don't they just land? I think to myself, thank God they don't.
I loved the Greg Witoich attitude. Look, if they want to come down and trade with me, then fine. Or why can't these non-humans put some kind of an agreement together, and they can just go to the slaughterhouses and take any damn thing that they want, but leave my bull alone in the pasture?
Yeah. Well, a bull is an awfully valuable animal, and it's a shame to lose one like that. Well, Linda, speaking of losing, we're about at the end of our time together, but just one more thing, and that is that the Baptist preacher I was referring to, I believe, is still available as of August the 18th, 2007, in Free Dreamland. If not, it's from late July, and it will be available in the subscriber section archive for the next 3 or 4 years. So if you're hearing this years from now, you can probably still listen to it. It's a remarkable story indeed of a minister who is willing to give his name and step up to the plate and say exactly what he saw with his own eyes. And it is just, well, frankly, it makes horror movies seem like a welcome relief.
Right. And bottom line, the worldwide animal mutilations continue to this day in both hemispheres.
And bottom line, the beauty and extraordinary value of the crop circle phenomenon continues also. So where does it all come out? It's a big, complicated experience, and this is a very weird universe. Thank you very much, Linda Holt-Moldenhau. Don't miss a single week of Dreamland. You really don't get this anywhere else anymore at all, this kind of in-depth discussion and reporting on edge subjects. This is the last place, folks. The light, this is it. It's still shining here. We'll talk to you again next week.
This has been Whitley Strieber's Dreamland. Thanks very much for listening. We'll be back next week with another journey to the extreme edge of controversy on Dreamland. Do not miss it.